Humanity in healthcare is seeing and being seen, and hearing and being heard, and healing and being healed.
More human healthcare means I know what matters to my patients, not just what's the matter with
them. And more human healthcare means extending kindness, compassion and fair treatment, regardless of my faith, nationality and race. Remembering that underneath it all, we're all human.
More human healthcare means remembering everyone involved is human.
As staff, it would mean the umbrella of safety and compassion is extended to me. As a patient, it would mean not to be unfavorably cared for because of who I am.
More human healthcare means a warm and listening face, an attitude of respect, and an honest and open response.
Humanized healthcare for me is more than just dressing my wounds. It's holding my hand, looking into my eyes, asking how I feel. It's checking that I'm not scared, treating me like a human being.
Welcome to the Humanising Healthcare podcast series from the Point of Care Foundation. Today's episode asks the question, why is medicine so medical? And explores ideas around humanising care from the perspective of people with a long-term health condition. I'm Beth Fitzsimons and I'm Chief Executive of the Point of Care Foundation. And today I'd like to welcome Sherelle Augustine, Nordia Willis and Sandra Jayakodi. They'll introduce themselves and tell their own stories, but the common thread that links them is a long experience of treatment and care from the health system. They're going to talk about what a more human healthcare system would look like from their point of view as people with long-term health conditions. Sherelle, Nordia and Sandra, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. You're very welcome.
Okay, so my name is Nordia Willis. I have sickle cell disease. I currently am in work and I work for the NHS, a service manager.
Hi, my name is Sandra Jayakodi. I live in London and I used to work as a solicitor before, but due to my long-term mental health conditions, I had to leave my profession and now I'm actively involved in patient and public involvement and engagement in research, quality improvement, healthcare, service design, and also training.
I'm Sherelle, 34. I also have sickle cell, living with sickle cell, pretty much been in and out of hospital my entire life. And I'm currently employed by Imperial College / Arc Northwest London. And obviously on the side, I do, you know, we do have our charity Broken Silence and we do a lot of, well, at the moment we do a lot of behind the scenes raising awareness of sickle cell and just trying to make a difference in, you know, the healthcare systems and the way that we're treated.
So, I mean, you've all worked with us in the past, and you know the sort of strap line of the Point of Care Foundation is the mission is to humanise healthcare. And if I sort of say that to you, as a person who's got a long-term condition, what would you interpret that as meaning to you? What does a human healthcare system feel like, look like?
For me, I'll say patient involvement, patient awareness, patient and also clinician working together. Those are like a few of the stuff that come to mind.
What about you, Sherelle? Does it mean the same sort of thing to you as well?
Those things, definitely, but also just seeing me as a person, like not just a number or not just a statistic or trying to understand, you know, because a lot of the time they generalize you by your health condition or something like that, whereas no two people are the same and they don't react the same, and sometimes you need to understand where the person's coming from to be able to give them advice and to change their, you know, to help them have the best holistic care. So not just their care in hospital, but how they go back home and look after themselves, and just being empowered. I think a lot of the time sometimes you're made to feel small in your decisions, like you're not doing the best thing for your health or for your well-being. And instead of it being more of a two-way conversation and understanding both sides and realizing that I'm actually intelligent enough, I've got a profession to understand the science and the research and everything behind things as well. It's sometimes that's missing, I find.
And what about you, Sandra?
I agree totally with what Cheryl and Nadia has said. And also to add on to that, it's also about, when you talk about human care, it's about person-centered care. And we have heard about this terminology for a long time. And that means when you're caring for someone, especially with long-term health conditions, you need to look at, like what Cheryl said, you have to look at their whole environment. You know, what is it that matters to them? What is it that they need to help them recover? It's just not the clinicians or the experts telling you this is what you need to do, but also hearing from them, what is it that they want, that they can do to help with their own recovery as well? So I think that conversation kind of is lost in the process, and that conversation is important. And that conversation can only come about if you actually empower the patients to do that. For instance, your cultural background, your beliefs might not allow you to kind of question certain professions or clinicians whom you think they are the experts, so, and you would be fearful. But I think we need to break that culture and empower the patients to able to question anything that there comes to mind without worrying or being frightened or like what Cheryl mentioned, you know, I might be just a small person. And so what would I contribute? You know, just to break all those barriers and give that power to the patients for their own recovery.
Can you think of an example in your own background where someone's done, you know, has treated you in a way and it would be the epitome of what was a human interaction, a good positive healthcare interaction?
When I was laid off my job because of my poor health, and you're lost, and suddenly you have no income. You know, someone who has been working and earning well and have to leave the profession for health reasons. That means I became poorer because of my health. Mm. And I didn't know at that time what help I could access or what was it there for me. And my healthcare worker, she was very, very helpful. And she came and told me, look, these are the things that you can access now because you're not working anymore and you've got a long-term mental health condition. And if she didn't have that conversation with me and ask me questions, I think I would have just left the hospital without knowing what I'm going to do next. Yeah. So although to me it was like, oh my God, what is she suggesting? Have I to go on benefits now? She was having a conversation with me, and in a way that was really kind of really, really helpful. Yeah.
Sounds like she cared about you as a person.
I think for me, just a few people will come to mind in terms of healthcare. One of them being my GP. We have also the specialist sickle cell nurse that Cheryl would know, this one I'm talking about, that we had. She was absolutely fantastic. And we've had a couple of doctors, sickle cell consultants that Cheryl and I again would agree that we thought that were fantastic because they listened to you. You felt that you was having a one-to-one service with them. Like I had a sickle consultant who, if I missed an appointment, would ring me and say, why am I not here sitting in front of her? And that, you know, like to even know your patient like that for me is something special. Like to even to be so bothered to pick up the phone and say, I'm sorry, you were supposed to be here. Because at the time I was a teenager and there's certain stuff that I didn't want to do. And I didn't, in terms of a hospital appointment, sometimes I'm like, oh, it's not that important. I'm not. But with her having that, you know, having that one-to-one connection and conversation, she will know to pick up the phone and say, well, you know, you're meant to be here. Why are you not here? Like, this is about your health. And so it felt like you was being cared for and looked after correctly. And there's like, they genuinely care for you. There's been a few times when I had to go and see my GP, and he's very much like, well, he makes me feel like, well, you know more about your illness than I do. You're, you know, so what works for you? Like, he would ask, okay, so what tablets do you want? What works for you? What takes away the pain? Stuff like that. So for me, that's been like, that's very helpful. Like, those are the ones that I have, you know, positivity thing to say about.
One thing that really sticks out to me and why I am how I am today was Dame Professor Sally Davis, because she was one of the consultants Nadia mentioned. And she was looking after me from birth to a certain age. And she never used to just speak to my parents. She would always speak to me as well. So it wasn't like I was insignificant or wasn't part of the conversation or I was being talked about. It was always directed to me, explaining in a way that I could understand no matter what age I was. And that really made me more have more control about my condition, just from my understanding of my condition. And she was very honest as well. It wasn't no like bubble wrapping. It was like, if you don't do this, you'll die. It was very straight to the point and caring at the same time. And it wasn't like I was enough. So for her, it was like she would know my case. I bet if I met her now, she would still remember my condition. Do you know what I mean? And that's very rare. And I haven't seen her for like a couple of decades now, I'm sure. And that really made a difference to how I was raised, because I had my mum enforcing that at home, but I also had a consultant that spoke to me and empowered me to understand my condition, not my limitations, but how I could be limited by or impacted by my condition, or how my decisions impacted my life, rather than you should just do this and that was it. It was always a conversation. It was always an explanation. It was always tailored to just me.
And I think you just genuinely felt cared for, like, genuine care.
You felt, it makes you feel accountable for them, to them as well.
Exactly.
It's not just like, oh, I'm just a nobody to them. You feel, when you don't do what you're supposed to do, you feel bad to say it.
Yeah.
Which isn't what they were intending, but because they care so much, it's like an extension of your family.
Mm.
I also remember when I was receiving home treatment care, and one of the social worker would come around to the house. And I remember at one point when the home treatment care ended, I was telling her, like, do you know what? You have been so helpful. You have been so kind. You are the best person. And I think I was like going on and on praising her. And it was simply because she, for some reason, came across as a person who was more proactive. She was not waiting for me, because bearing in mind at that time or that frame of mind that I was in, I was not able to understand anyone. I was not able to comprehend anything. But for her to sit down and actually take me through the whole process, and everything changed. My life totally changed as a result of my long-term diagnosis. She took me through, like practically holding my hand, and, you know, what are the things that I need to look out for, including my daughter, you know, what kind of support that she can get. And so it was, I think if those two people were not in my life and if they were not proactive to tell me, I would have faced more struggles with my illness.
It does sound like there's a real common thread of being held in mind by people, and that's what's been really special, isn't it? I suppose one of the questions I want to ask you really is, most people go into healthcare with the best of intentions. So what do you think gets in the way of them doing their best for patients in a more humanised way?
I personally think, because sometimes, you know how patients always don't want to be the last to know. I think sometimes a lot of the frontline staff are the last to know about things going on in their own hospital. They always say, like, many times I've heard nurses say that, you know, we always know what's going to happen before they do. And then there's always a lot of policy and procedure changes. And I think time restrictions around that. And usually the people putting these policies in place have never actually been on the front line. So they don't know how it works. So they just implement these things that they don't know if it works or not, and they don't like review it or anything like that. So it just puts a lot of strain and extra paperwork, which is, some of it can be seen as unnecessary. And then there's the other element of, sometimes people have experienced a certain amount of patients that are negative towards them or have a negative mindset or act negatively, and then they kind of link it to the condition, or they have fellow staff members tell them, oh, people with this condition are quite difficult, and it just kind of changes their mindset for a set of people, kind of like a stigma on them people.
It could also be that, you know, they're really overworked. And also, including, you know, we talk about now a lot about this human care, patient-centered care, humanizing treatment. But when they were qualifying, when they became healthcare professionals, at the time that they were receiving their training, how much of this was in their training? You know, so they have embarked on a journey with that, which was the very old system of how we provide care. And now as we evolve, we keep looking at new ways of treating patients and caring for patients. So how much of this new way of treating or caring has been inputted into the existing staffs? You know, what do they know about it? The other thing that I think, especially like what Cheryl said, was, you know, when you have new guidelines and policies, guidelines and policies are always guidelines and policies. Are they enforceable? If they do not follow, what happens to that? I can give you an example with mental health. There's a big talk about physical health for patients with mental illness, where they find that there's a disparity. And also they find that people with long-term mental health conditions, life expectancy can be reduced by 20 years. So the government is putting the NHS is putting a lot of money into improving the physical health assessment of inpatients and also in the community. So there have been guidelines, there have been policies, but still, till today, we look at it, it's not really happening to the standard that is expected to happen. So there are policies set in place. Trainings have been given to the staffs. So why is it still not happening?
What do you think can be done about these sorts of problems, the gap between what's supposed to happen and what actually happens?
It has to be some sort of accountability. Who is responsible for if this is not being carried out?
Like what consequences are there when these are not being done, when these gaps are not being filled? Do you, Sandra said, do you just leave it? And how do you fill these gaps? So if there's no consequences, then people don't really take stuff seriously enough. Like if there's no, like, you know, if you don't have to account for anything, people generally think that, oh, you know, it's a tick box exercise, like whether it's done or not, it's one of those tick box exercises. There's no consequences for it, so really and truly, what's the point?
Do you think it's just because, you know, these aspects are just not a top enough priority for leaders, say? Is that what's behind it?
Whether it is priority or not, it's not. What matters is what is important for the patient. What is important for the patient? For the patient, both the mental and physical health is important. You know, one feeds on the other. So these are priorities, and these priorities are being talked about every day. You know, this you see conferences, you see newsletters, you see publications, you see research, you see health policies and guidelines from NHS and NICE guidelines. So why is this, people are still not feeling it as this important? Why is it not important? Why are they ignoring it? They're ignoring it because there's no accountability.
Yeah. It's just like, for an example, like when I go into A&E for, you know, a crisis, and over and over again, my sickle protocol has just been ignored. But what is the consequences of that protocol being ignored? Like, even though for me, if for you, for them ignoring it, the consequences for me is, you know, crucial, because I end up in high dependency and stuff like that. You know, my treatment time takes longer, my recovery time takes longer. But from the time I go into A&E what is the consequence of them ignoring my secret protocol, even though I'm flashing it in their face?
But we cannot, this to me is just like, I cannot put this as a blanket statement that this is what is happening. There is good and there is bad.
Of course.
You know, so we need to take it in equal proportion. We cannot assume everyone is bad. No. But when things don't happen, there's a reason why it doesn't happen.
Yeah. I think as well, there's an element of not only consequence, but reward. Because I know that they have things like the sequence. So if certain people implement certain, I guess it's changes or policies or get hit certain targets, there's a sequence funding that they get. And that motivates people in a different way. So it's like you've got accountability, but you've also got to make them feel like, well, what am I getting from it? Because I feel like a lot of the time, I guess if they're just bombarded with extra work to do, and these things fall through the gaps and they're just like, okay, whatever. But sometimes it's nice to be told, oh, you're doing a good job and this is what you get for doing a good job.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to, we all like to be told when we're doing a good job, don't we?
Yeah, and you get that less than you do getting told when you haven't done. Because half the time you can do 98% of your job correct, and then the one time you mess up, you know, they come down on you like a ton of bricks, like you've never done anything good. So most people are used to getting that negative feedback rather than positive feedback.
Yeah, really important point. So last one from me, really, which is really just to think about, if you had a magic wand and you could just fix a couple of things that would make your experience better, what would it be?
For me, I think this is the first thing that came to my head, really. And I think it's because I use this system a lot. For me, I think I'll start with A&E, because my journey begins in A&E when I'm being brought in by the ambulance. Like, generally, I don't have a problem being brought in by the ambulance. But as soon as I hit A&E, that's where my journey sort of messes up a bit. And I can always tell what kind of stay I'm going to have by how I'm treated in A&E going forward onto the wards. So that's the first thing that came to my head. I'll probably wave that wand at A&E first.
So you'd make sure that your protocol was paid attention to at the front door of the hospital.
Exactly, because it just sets the pace for what happens next and how long I'm going to stay in that hospital, sort of thing.
Great, thanks, Nordia.
But I think also to have more of an integrated service rather than just, you know, everyone providing their own care for the patient, but it's more integrated that I can talk with one person about all my care. You know, then I don't know if they're making sense enough, because my father was in hospital for various cancer. He had kidney was malfunctioning, and he had to have a surgery on remove his bladder, prostate, and his kidney. And then we had to see so many different people, and sometimes it was so confusing, and it was very dreadful for my father as well. And the worst thing was he couldn't speak the language as well. And so it was very hard. So I wish at that time that there could have been someone who could, from the healthcare professional, who's like a professional interpreter, who could have done that. Something small like that can make a difference in a patient's recovery and confidence. You know, when you need to make them feel confident that what they're going through, it's sometimes the fear in itself can be a setback for your recovery, you know. So so the way you approach and the way you talk to the person in a very integrated manner, and just, or not to say, oh, I'm just dealing with your kidney, you need to speak to the other person or the other one, you need to phone that person. And then by the time you phone that person, your anxiety level increases, you know. So to hear someone to say, don't worry, I will check on them and I will make sure that they give you a call. And instead of pushing the burden on the patient, you know, but to say, don't worry about it, I will make sure that I get the information that you need and they'll come and speak to you.
Yeah, I agree with what Sandra's saying, because what I'm getting from that is the communication and transparency. Just to add on to what Sandra's saying, because when I've had care where I'm being seen about multiple different things like I am right now, what they have done is done joint clinics for me specifically, not just for me, but for like a lot of people like me with sickle cell. And it changes everything because you're not coming in for more appointments. They come together in one room and you can discuss these different elements together in one room, and they can talk to each other about what they think works for the patient and all that stuff. And I think if there was a system, like, for example, where the IT side of things were all linked across the UK, it would make it so much easier, because a lot of the time they ask me, when did you do this? When did you do that? Now I'm in hospital for MOTs all throughout the year, so I don't even remember dates half the time, or when's the last time I had an MRI, for example. So if they could just like pull it up and see, like put my details in, my NHS number, and see all the things like listed together of what, you know, and they could click it and see the results, it'll just make it so much easier for them to communicate across institutes as well. I don't know if that's the right word for them, but yeah. But I think my own input would be just seeing people as individuals, like just that equality, just not having like you see someone and you have a expectation of how they're going to behave or what you're going to get from them, or you have, or you see their condition and you assume that you're going to get a difficult person. I think if it was everybody was looked at as a blank slate, it would help with the way we're treated, it would help with the inequalities in health.
That's really great. It's a really great way to end it. I think that's really important.
You know, Beth, you really started off by asking what good experiences we had, because most of the time, whenever you are, everybody is always talking about the negative things. So kind of, you know, and we never think about the good services that we have had received. And I think that was really, really nice. And for me to go back, like, when did this happen? 2006. So how many years ago? You know, going back and to remembering that good care that I had received, it's really, it's, yeah, it just triggered some memories. So it's really,
yeah, just, yeah. We can learn a lot from good stuff as well as the bad, yeah, stuff, can't we?
I hope you enjoyed listening to the Point of Care Foundation podcast today. If you liked what you heard, please join us again next time when we'll be talking about humanising healthcare for people using mental health services. If you like our podcast, please do consider subscribing so that you don't miss an episode. You can also find our podcast on the Point of Care Foundation website, as well as on Spotify, Apple, Google, and all the usual podcast platforms. Thanks very much for joining us today. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.